I guess Christmas still continues here. We just sang a carol. And tonight will be an expression of many gifts. Is one of them now. Tim Kieschnick gave us a gift, the trumpet. Okay. Marty Haugen gave us a gift on the piano. Ginny Nelson and Jerry Hoeksema will give us a gift as they dance. And Tosh Jordan. Are you ready? Okay. Tosh Jordan will give us a gift as he plays his flute. And my gift will be these objects that I've made. This is also the summer of 1983, during which the theme is Feast of Life, taken from John Polton's book, which was written for the Vancouver Assembly. And in that book, Polton describes what he says is a Eucharistic life. And obviously, that phrase comes from Eucharist. And in my tradition, that was called communion. And in a systematic way, Polton goes through that book and he says that there are many levels of reality that we can know in the Eucharist. Some of them are obvious. We remember Jesus' death as we were commanded. We share in that death. We reenact somehow the fact that Jesus died and we died at the same time. We also, as Polton suggests, take on the deaths of others. We are aware of death and we see it around us. And that act of Christ enables us to stare it down, go through it, defeat it. It's not just a phenomenon that happens in other people, in other places. We carry it with us, like Christ carried it with him. But we renew what Christ did for us. We reapprehend the life that Jesus made possible. And Polton goes to great lengths to explain how this can only be fully apprehended together. It's not an individual gift, merely. There's a richness to it, a fullness that cannot be understood unless it is communion, the cup of sharing. And in so doing, we recommit ourselves to disseminating that truth. Now, in all this, it seems to me that the distinctions between life and death get rather blurred. If the Christian is a person who's alive physically and alive in many other ways, but we take on death, and if the Christian is a person who's always apprehending death and going through it, and if the Christian is a person who has life and knows another life beyond, it seems like the distinctions of death and life, perhaps fearful, convenient distinctions, maybe they don't apply anymore, since we are now, all of you, you're dying and living in many ways. You may be dying as your spouse is dying or as some relative. You carry that with you. Or you may be carrying the death of many people in many parts of the world. But as you do, I suspect that you apprehend a new aspect of life. Now, it seems to me that such a life is a life without fear. It enables us to not blink when this phenomenon that's conveniently called death passes by. It enables us to live life exuberantly, daringly perhaps, taking some risks. It points to our commonness. We all share something. Maybe that's what one of the things we remember in communion. We're in this thing together. We all need it. We learn in the experience of it together. Common origins, common ends. Now, I thought about this for a long time. I read the book at the beginning of the summer, and I thought, a visual image. I like to make that very concise. An image, well, I live by images. I think we all live by remembrances, things we saw, faces, images. So my burden was to condense that, to find something that had to do with life and death in the same place, that had to do with universality, it had to do with the fact that all people are in there or have their source in it, that we're all the same somehow. And I think there is such an image around us. Perhaps a compost pile, a lowly compost pile. Not a compost pile as a literary person would say, the compost heaps of civilization. That's a different sense, and those aren't really compost anyway. That's left over, that's considered to be an end. But compost isn't an end. The soil doesn't end. I suggest to you that the soil is not inert. It's alive. It smells sweet. Things are growing. Things are dying in it. That's why it's rich. Now, have you noticed in your hikes that certain rotting logs, or even on the forest floor anywhere, in the rich colors of the floor of the forest, have you noticed the surprising explosions of orange? Have you seen the orange? I don't know if they're liverworts or if they're mushrooms or what, but they're exotic. Have you seen those little fragile yellow things? They're like little tendrils, like something that you would buy that's plastic and you would scrub dishes with it. I don't know what that is, but it's surprising. Have you noticed the color of lichens? Strange mixtures of blues and greens and browns. Let me suggest to you that in those places, the colors of life are the colors of death. They are indistinguishable. The fabric, the textures of life and death are the same. And so, I offer the first image of soil. Now, if you dig around in the soil, and if you live by the soil, it doesn't take long to realize this stuff is alive. There are explosions of energy and life in there. Things have died so that other things come back. Now, this process, bones, garbage, trees, leaves, this could go on, I suppose, unendingly if nature just kept going. It seems like it's a cosmic pattern, as if, how could I describe it? Irrepressible God, perhaps. In the most surprising places, newness, renewal, life. Most surprising places, the stuff we walk on in the forest floor. Now, there is another very ominous symbol as proud as that is humble. This is kind of an alternate image. And may I suggest that we have the tailings. Now, what are tailings as opposed to soil? Well, I think, among other things, tailings could be material that has been removed, or at least is outside of, that cycle of renewal. It can't go back, it can't go forward, it just sits there. To me, it's arrogant. It just, all right, change me, renew me. Feels that way. And it's very big, and its color impresses itself on me. Now, arrogant may be an inappropriate word, but it seems to me that the origins of that material come from a very specific, a not necessarily humble relationship to nature, to the cycles of nature. Now, what if things went up there and died? Chipmunks, leaves, snakes, worms. What if we threw a bunch of stuff up there? Excrement are doing that. At some point, irrepressible God comes back. Little explosions of energy, renewal. Imagine the atomic activity, the molecular activity when that begins to occur. The same surprising colors and shapes. Things that are fruit, things that are stalks, life, pulsing, once again. So we have two convenient symbols, tailings and soil. Now it seems to me that those are instructive for us. We can take on the characteristics of either one. We can decide for ourselves, I will stand outside of this cycle, this biblical cycle, this Eucharistic cycle. I will not die. I will not learn that new life. I will, as it were, be arrogant. Or we can say, I will be humble, like the soil. There are many things that we can learn from the soil. We all live by it, do we not? In the end, we could be sun worshipers. We live by these little tiny growing things, little microbes in there. We live by that. How easy it is to forget. We don't live by grocery stores. It's common to us all. We began there. We were made of dust. To dust we return. We can all apprehend it. We've all seen soil. We can all go in our backyard or somebody's backyard and dig around and be reminded. We can meditate on that. And I think we can live humbly. For it cannot be an accident that our word for humility comes from the word humus, which is to say the soil. So we can live this Eucharistic life, which is necessarily a humble life. And by that, I mean we can understand all the things that happen to us as a grand pattern, which has at its beginning, at its end, at its medium, which is constantly sustained by, and which at every point reveals this one that we call Jesus.
What do you suppose God looked like in the beginning? What came to your mind as Judy was reading those things about creatures, sea monsters, things like this, maybe things that we don't see, maybe energy, maybe what did God look like hovering over the water? Like Michelangelo's God, an old Italian gentleman? Probably not. What did it feel like for God to be there? We get the impression from Genesis 1, which is the first reading, that all that stuff that was around evidenced God. What else could it do? It was direct. There was the maker and there was the stuff, and what else could it be but expressive of the maker? Now, since then, we've realized that there's a lot more that we couldn't see that could have been described there, other than in the Genesis metaphors. Things about diatoms, those little creatures in the sea, subatomic particles that are quite real, electrical charges. I hope you caught some of that. I think that's what the artist had in mind. I should know. I made them. And so I think we can get the impression that wherever this stuff was going on, there was God. God holds it together. The electrons, the neutrons, and the many other ions that are discovered, as well as the clouds, the trees, the things we see. I can accept that. I believe that. I want that to be true. But that's not all there is to it. In that, the second reading from Psalm 139 said that God is everywhere, that God is in heaven, and that God is in Sheol, the Old Testament metaphor for hell, I believe. God in hell? Most unlikely. Well, let's just take that for granted. I mean, the Bible says so. God far across the sea, or in the uttermost reaches of the sea. In that case, in their time, there were many unexplored areas or unknown places. For us, let's say just somewhere else. The next room, God's in there. Down the street, God's in somebody's house that you don't like. God's in some other nation that we don't like. He's there. She's there. God is in the night, the dark. And I take that to mean that God is also in those places where there is fear, uncertainty, death, whatever. God is there. Now, it doesn't take much imagination for us to picture that. We've seen hell. We've made some. I experience it now and then. When I say to myself, oh, God's not here. God's not there in Nagasaki. God couldn't have been there. Well, what if God was there? What would God look like? Now you might think, well, that's a stupid idea. Typical artist, right? I spent my whole summer thinking of that. Well, I need to do a little bit of autobiography here. Ever since I was a child, images like this, by the media and because of the way I was programmed, I guess, they have had great impact on me. In seventh grade, I did a report on Hiroshima, and on the cover of it, a cover that made my teacher go, wow, what's this? He was really impressed. I think I got a good grade on that, too. And there was a large mushroom cloud. You know, we all lived through Vietnam, but all the other cataclysms in history, regardless of who did what to whom, the fact that they happened, they weigh on me. In what serves as my studio now, without knowing it, I ended up making a drawing that was a Eucharist at Wounded Knee. How morose. Well, that stuff just comes in and it stays there. That may be one of the reasons why today I am never very far from anger and despair. So in the last year, my central meditation has come to be Emmanuel, God with us. Because what I need to know most, is God here? Not necessarily, or not simply, is God in places like that, which we could do many times over. Is God in the thinking that leads to that? Or even, is God in here? Is God in me? When I feel like I could have been a guard at Auschwitz, when I'm very angry and hateful. I have that capacity. I think we all do. Maybe those are hell. the foretaste of hell, where there's no recognition that God could be around. Well, does that matter? Big deal. So we got some image of God in our minds. Well, it seems to me that not only do we live by images, that being the prime one, but that those images change us. And so I have made a painting behind the screen here for me, for a person who's on the edge of despair or fear, a person who wears all those things in my head and I have to do something with them. Maybe you're like that. Just the fact that they happen, maybe you have to decide, what do I do? Do I get all choked up? Do I worry? Do I fear? So is that just a nice metaphor? We can decorate in our minds and say, oh yeah, God's around, it'll all be nice. That's not the point. I need an awareness of God because it determines what I will do. It determines what I will be. So let me suggest to you, I have made a painting that I call Eucharist at Nagasaki because I wanted to believe that God was there. Maybe not like this. And maybe not like all the associations that will come to your mind from seeing this painting. But I had to make it for myself because my awareness of God or the image that I have of God determines who my enemies are, at what I get angry or impatient, what I trust in, who my neighbor is, what my neighbor is. It determines who I am. In a moment, some music will begin, which is the prelude to our final hymn. Song number 126 in our books. For a moment, I'd like you to think on this, think on what the scriptures say, think on what your image of God is, because I suspect that's who we become. That's what unleashes or confines us. Maybe we need to really see God in the most unlikely places that are concentrations of what appear to be the absence of God. Have we begun yet? How do you know? Because I'm here now, so we must have begun. Actually, the beginning was about 8 minutes ago when the last two pieces of Handel's Messiah began. It was kind of a controlled experiment. I wanted to see if that music would command attention or if it would feel like it was background music. For me, that particular music cannot stay in the background. That's an important motif, because that suggests some of what else I will say later on, and because that piece has a particular influence on this object. My name is Daryl Nelson. I've been resident artist here for the summer. Have been because my family and I are leaving tomorrow. Judy Madison will be sharing a meditation of her own today, and Gary Santum and Verlon Brown will be playing some music. Now, I didn't think I was that funny. Actually, that's all part of the script. I wrote that in. He was actually supposed to run out there, not here. I imagine you're all here because of my charisma, right? No. Because of the announcement on the board, the last painting, right? No, because of the entertaining announcement at lunch. That's why, right? Because it's too hot outside, right? Well, you're here. And I hope you stay for 15 minutes because we'll be done. No, the actual event does not involve ice cream or popcorn or things that I can give to you and you keep in your hand. It involves more important things. The condensation of several lives into brief moments. In my case, a condensation, in a way, of my 33 years into an object. Condensation, even though this is an improvisational piece, more or less, that they'll be playing, it's necessarily a result of their whole lives. And Judy's reading of her own work will be necessarily the result of her whole life. So in that way, it's much more important than popcorn, I hope. Now, we have this painting here, which you can't see. That's the mystery behind the bedsheet. I'm not going to explain the painting because I don't know what it means. I should. I made it. And we could stop there because there are lots of things that happen to us and we don't know what they mean. And if nothing else, this could be a model For me, I dreamed this image at least 6 months ago. It didn't go away, like that music doesn't go away. Certain parts of the Messiah never go away. I listen to it frequently, sometimes almost daily during the semester. I suspect that you have images, feelings, sounds that don't go away, that keep asserting themselves. And we may or may not know what they mean. In my case, I began to learn what this meant by dialoguing with it, by giving it shape. Maybe that's a model, I don't know. In any case, I can't say the painting refers just to this. And in that way, what I'm going to do now is give you kind of a model of how, I suppose, any creative endeavor occurs. So what I'll do is describe some other things that have been going on in my life. And then after that, dramatically rip the sheet off the painting and let you decide for yourself. You can ooh or make some kind of guttural sound when I do that, just to make me feel like you're with me. I teach at a college, and one of the courses I teach, or two of the courses, are Art History Survey. And it has become obvious to me and to my students that rectangles have not always occurred in the making of things by people. There are many cultures who made things round, houses, large structures, because it modeled for them the cosmos. I don't know if we could say a rectangle models the cosmos for us, given the nature of rectangles, or let's say a grid. Well, grids began to appear on streets at a certain point because someone perceived that streets are more orderly if you lined them up like that. The Romans had off-street parking and one-way traffic, for example. It seems to me that even as an art historian, which I'm not, I'm an observer, that rectangles can be critiqued and they are very powerful. They are shapes that have to do with modular units. They can be repeated, they can be measured, you can build high things with them. They're consistent. They're much like rational logic. This fits with this, it's a little crystalline structure. So much for rectangles. You ever notice a final thought on rectangles? That the city is full of rectangles, and we see very few on a hike up to Heart Lake. They don't occur much in nature, so they are a human shape, humans making things, humans making plans, and so we have rectangles. A next influence. I also teach a course called typography, and that means that in that course we study the shapes of letters. And the intent is that students can work with those and know how to use them better, learn different typefaces and what the meaning is of the different shapes. An A is not an A is not an A. They tape different shapes literally in different typefaces. Now, all letters are not the same. All languages do not have the same kind of configurations. Let's say pictographs, original Chinese script. What's a pictograph? It's a shape that you can pretty much connect with its source, with its multi-sensual source, trees, mountains, some kind of natural shape or sound of a mouth, but it's not abstract as much as ours in the sense that you can see a link, a sensual link. So there's a shape that stands for and is tied to a whole bunch of other human experiences. Now, in our case, because of the way history's happened, we can't say what an A means or a B. By itself, they don't mean anything. I mean, as a little shape. They mean something when you put it next to something else. So that's something else that I've thought. Now, since coming to Holden Village, some other things have occurred to me. One is that there's been a lot of talk here about left and right brain dynamics. I must think about that, too, as a teacher. And for those of you who haven't read much on that, I'll simplify it. In the left brain, it's generally agreed that certain kinds of planning, linear logic, let's say rectangular logic, where points meet points and diagrams can be made, where reason takes place, where things mean this and they fit with this. That occurs over here. On this side, on the right side, is intuition. Things that are spatially connected. They don't necessarily mean something, but they fit intuitively. Creativity supposedly comes from that side. So we have these two opposing awarenesses And as you can see, they link up with what else I've said. Now, since coming to Holden, I've heard much of that, and that's been connected with our awareness of God. God can be perceived this side or on this side. On this side, which is my tradition, basically, God is God, the name. And God does these kinds of things, and God is pretty much confined to this doctrine or this, almost this mental shape. On the other side, let's say a right brain, a visual, meditative, non-rational awareness of God, one becomes aware of God as nameless, as something that you can't define, not something, total reality, not separate from anything else, totally interconnecting, the fabric of all things. It sounds like what many Eastern mystics have said. The great Tao cannot be named. And once you name it, you don't have it. God is like that to this side of the brain. Now, finally, another influence since I came here has been that I've read this book called The Tao of Physics. And in that book, the writer proved successfully, I think, that subatomic physics parallel, almost prove what the mystics were saying about ultimate reality, because subatomic physics works in four dimensions and cannot really be visualized. There are mathematical formulae which are like rectangles, and that they are the maps of the territory and the actual movements of protons and nucleons and electrons. That's the real stuff. But the real stuff is kind of right brain, because it's constantly moving, constantly dynamic, ever-changing. You can't say that an electron is this, because it's defined by its action with other electrons. It's like God, in a way. And so, 6 months ago or so, I had this dream. And so, in the last couple months, or last couple weeks, actually, I've made this painting. Thank you.
As Daryl was saying, all people know God differently and respond in individual ways. The same applies to art. Your response and reaction belongs to you, and it's valid. I will share with you my reaction to Daryl's work. While I'm reading, keep your full attention on the painting. No doubt you will notice that you have responses of your own based on what you're hearing and what you're seeing. And there's no right or wrong, just opportunity. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Where is God and what is God like? We hear voices speaking across centuries telling us of a God who is just, compassionate, suffering, caring, powerful, wise, creator, loving father, nurturing mother, Jesus, spirit. But what does God look like? Where do we see God? We see a loving God in fragile mountain laurel and a newborn's fingers in pink, lavender, and the promise of spring. We see God's power in mountains and the hurling movement of objects blown in a windstorm. God's suffering weeps in gray and disintegration. God spins out of history and confronts us with the firm form of Jesus against a background of uncertainty and chaos. God lingers among the familiar, spilling over in a new design. Yet how do we paint the fragrance of lilacs, or see justice, or sketch wisdom? It is the very fact that we cannot see God, which tells us God is there, in mystery, the unexplainable, that which is shapelessly undefinable. Look for the signs of God everywhere. You will feel their presence, saying, tell them I am has sent you. I am who I am. Thank you.